Welcome to the Woodshop Life Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast focused on the craft of woodworking. I'm Sean Walker of Simple Cove, and I'm joined today by Hui Huynh of Alabama Woodworker.
Hey.
How's it going? And Guy Dunlap of Guy's Woodshop.
How are you, man?
Pretty good. So this podcast is intended to answer questions from the woodworking community and to give you some of our perspectives on how we get things done in our own shops. Before I get started, I want to mention that we also have a new Patreon account. Right now, we have one level, and we're simply asking for a small donation just to try to cover the costs of bringing you this podcast. Head on over to patreon.com/woodshoplife to learn more. We sincerely hope that you'll give us your support. Let's get right into it. Hui, what do you got for us?
All right. So my first question is from CR Woodshop, and he asks, thanks first off for your insight into the woodworking world of woodworking. I've got a question regarding the differences between a 12-inch disc sander, like a Rycon 12-inch, which lists for $299, and an oscillating edge spindle sander by Rigid, which lists for $249. What are the benefits of each? What do you guys prefer? It seems like the Rigid has more capability and is cheaper, but am I missing something? Any other thoughts on them or similar machines? So if you're unfamiliar with the Rigid belt and spindle sander, it has these two attachments. The first is an oscillating belt or edge sanding attachment, and the other are various size oscillating spindles. And these all fit in the same machine, and it's relatively a compact machine. It also has a tilting table that allows you to do sanding at an angle. It's a pretty cool tool. In fact, actually, I looked this up recently, and Fine Woodworking Magazine voted it best value and best overall tool for 2007. It's been out for a while now. So it's a good tool, but that's not to say that it's perfect, right? So there are some limitations with it. I know that turners like to use large disc sanders for cleaning up segmented layers. So obviously the limited size of the Rigid is going to be a limiting factor for reference surfacing, right? Also, changing out the edge and spindle takes a little bit of time. That's likely not much of a concern, but maybe something to consider if you're looking at the differences between the belt sander, spindle sander combo versus a dedicated disc sander. So for instance, I have a dedicated spindle sander and I have a dedicated belt / disc sander combo, and they're right next to each other. So I can use the belt and disc sander to feather or fair outside curves. And then when I have an inside curve, I can switch over to the spindle sander without switching out any attachments. And again, probably not a big deal, but something to consider. So those are sort of the two cons or the limiting factors for in terms of size and switching over attachments. And the main benefit to the Rigid over a disc belt combination sander would be that the Rigid sander allows you to sand both outside curves and inside curves on the same machine, lowering your footprint. And the oscillation also extends the life of your sandpaper. And you'll see also a reduction in noticeable scratches on your workpiece because of the oscillation. The Rigid it's really a great compact tool for a small workshop. And if I didn't have a dedicated spindle and belt / disc sander combo, I'd probably get the Rigid sander. So that's, you know, sort of my two cents. Guy, what are you working with? And are there some benefits over one or the other that I didn't mention?
I do have the Rigid machine and I really like it. There are times I wish I had a larger disc sander though, for things that you had mentioned before, like segments and stuff like that, or a very long piece. And I want a flat edge on it. You really can't do that on the Rigid. The belt on it is only probably about 6 inches long, I think, if that. But it does give you the ability, you know, if you just want to round over an edge, let's say, you know, a round profile on something, you can just mark out something with a quarter, take it over that thing, and it's very aggressive. It'll round a corner off really quickly for you, just like a disc sander will. All that being said, the Rigid, for me anyways, does everything I need it to do. The only thing that sometimes I wish were different on it is that the spindle bobbins were taller. It only has a sanding stroke of a little over 3 inches. I think it's maybe 3.5 inches. So if you're trying to do the inside curve on something, it mostly comes into my thing when I'm doing like a bent lamination, I'm trying to sand the inside of something, or if I've bricked something to build up an apron, I'm trying to get the inside of that. I have to make sure that I know how tall that is before I go ahead and do it so I can clean up the inside. So my projects are being limited by the size of my sander. I know it's kind of backwards, but it's things you have to think about, you know, woodworking period. You know, it's great to design all this great stuff, but, you know, is your machine going to be able to handle it when you need it to do a task? So there are some limitations to it. It is a small machine. I've looked at getting that Harbor Freight 12-inch disc sander before. I probably, at some point in time, I'll probably pick one up, but the table on it is such a piece of junk. You know, even going into the Rikon at $300, that's a lot of coin for something I'm only going to be using once in a blue moon since I have the Rigid already. The Rigid also has really good dust collection, something I should also mention. It's very light. I don't keep it on a bench. I keep it stored away. And when I want to use it, I just pull it out, set it up on my bench, and I'm ready to go in a few minutes. So changing over from the belt to the spindle actually takes about 15, 20 seconds. It's a nothing to change it over.
Right.
So there's really not much to say other than that. They're two different machines that are used for different purposes. What about you, Sean?
My current setup is actually the Harbor Freight 12-inch disc sander and the Harbor Freight spindle sander. And you're absolutely right about the Harbor Freight disc sander. The table is just garbage. It's fully tightened down and I can just use two fingers and it'll flex. But I'm not super relying on that. I'm not putting a lot of pressure. I understand its limitations or its weaknesses rather, but I would love to switch both of those out to get the Rigid just because of the space saving. I definitely think that is very appealing for my shop because I don't use the disc sander that often, but when I do, I'm glad that I have it. I mainly use the spindle sander 90% of the time. But when I need it, disc sander is great.
What's the throw or the sanding length on your spindle sander, if you don't mind me asking?
I think 6 inches.
Okay. So it's much taller than the Rigid.
Yes. Yeah. I believe you got half of it on width and half of it on length, I guess. But yeah, I believe it's 6 inches. Don't quote me on that, but I believe it's 6 inches, give or take. But yeah, I've not needed the disc sander. I'm not even, I guess, for outside curves, but I've never used it for segmented pieces and put the whole thing on there because obviously you're not supposed to use the full width of the disc. You're supposed to only use the half that's going down so it doesn't flip the piece up. So I tend to stay on the left side of it, the left 6 inches of the disc for the most part. But if I were to start over, I'd probably get the Rigid just to save the space and it can do both things for me. That is my take on it. Thank Guy, you've got the next question for us.
All right. Before we go, I want to, Hui, what kind of spindle sander do you have?
I've got the Jet tabletop spindle sander.
And what's the reach on that? How big is the surface area on it?
The table size is 14.5 by 14.5. And then the stroke length is 1 inch, but the sleeves I think are like 5 inches.
Like 5 inches. Okay. Yeah. So it's a little bit more than.
Yeah. So I guess it's about, it'll do like a 7-inch tall piece edge to edge.
All right. I just wanted to ask that question because that's something to consider too. All right. My next question comes from Ryan from Ryan's Rough Cut Woodworking. I says, "Hey guys, I'm really enjoying the podcast. Very informative." Well, when you two guys are talking, it's informative. "I'm finally in a position to buy my first festool tools, and I plan on buying the Domino, track saw, and dust extractor. My question is, should I buy the TS75 and the DF700 with the Seneca adapters for smaller cutters, or go with the smaller models? Currently, 95% of my work could be done with the smaller versions, but I can see needing the bigger versions in the future. I live in Portland, Oregon, and can throw a rock out my window and hit someone selling a slab. Also, I can see myself purchasing an MFT-style table, and I'm not sure how well the 75 would work on it." Those are some good questions, and let's talk about the track saw first. Festool makes two basic sizes of track saws. They have the TS75 and the TS55, and what those numbers indicate is the depth of cut that those saws can handle. So for example, the TS-55 will do 55 millimeters deep, which is about 2 1/8 of an inch deep, while the 75 will do up to 3 inches. The big thing is on the 45 degree cut. Now, if you're going to be doing slab work and you're doing like waterfall edges and stuff like that, the TS-55 will only do 1 11/16 at a 45 degree, while the TS-75 will do 2 1/8 at a 45 degree. That's a big difference right there. You know, most slabs are 2 inches over 2 inches. So that's something to consider. The 75 also, of course, has a more powerful motor. I think it's 1500 or 1600 versus 1200 watt motors. It is going to, you know, cut a little bit easier. And it has to have a bigger motor because it's got a better cutting depth. As far as working with an MFT table, it doesn't matter whether it's a 55 or a 75. They'll both work just fine with an MFT table. I have a 55, and if I had it to do over again, I would have gotten the 75. I would have paid the extra money and gotten the 75. There's been a couple times where I wish I had the extra depth. Hasn't happened that often, but it has. That's my take on that. As far as the 700 versus the 500 dominoes, which is a smaller versus a larger one, he mentioned the Seneca adapters for the 700. And what that is, it's an adapter that allows you to put it, the 4, the 5. Does the 700 do 6 millimeter?
I don't think so. Let me look really quick.
So it allows you to do those two. And I know the 700 starts at maybe like the 8 millimeter dominoes and goes up from there. Mm-hmm. If you ever want to do anything with plywood or 3/4 inch material, you're going to have to get those adapters so you can use the smaller cutters.
So if I can interrupt you really quick, the DF700 does 8, 10, 12, and 14 millimeters. So the adapter
would... Okay, so it does start at 8.
Yeah. The adapter would do 4, 5, and 6.
Yeah. Thank you, Hui. You were doing that because you're so fast on your keyboard. I'd be still looking for my T, I think. But, you know, I have the DF500. I've never wanted... For, you know, just like the TS-55, there's times when I wish I had it, the larger model. With the DF-500, I've never wished I had the larger one. I don't do work with live edge slabs. I don't make large doors or gates or anything like that. Those are justifiable reasons to get a DF-700. The 700 is about 50% more to an already expensive machine with the domino. So when I looked at that stuff, you know, it just wasn't worth it for me. Now, I should say I never had used a 700. I went to a friend of mine's house that had a 700. The 700 is a joy to use. It's a much larger machine, obviously, but it's much heavier, but it's much smoother to use. I mean, it just purrs. When you use the 500, it's a little bit of a rough ride. You got to latch onto that thing and hold it pretty steady because it will walk on you if you're not careful. The 700, not at all. It doesn't. It just sits there. And I think that's going to help with alignment too. I have had some alignment issues with the 500, you know, here and there. That mostly has to do with how I was introducing the machine to the material. That's about all I can really say. For me, the DF500 does everything I've ever wanted the loose tenon joiner to do, but I do wish I went with the TS75. What about you, Hui?
I completely agree between the TS55 and TS75. I wish I had gotten the TS75 at first, and I completely agree with the DF500. I've never had a desire to have the DF700.
On to you, Sean.
I agree with you. I would have gone the TS75.
I'm just kidding. Keep going, Hui. Go ahead.
I've used the the DF700, and it is a joy to use, but I've never needed that deep or that large of a loose tenon. And that's pretty much it. Sean, how about you?
Well, I'm probably the wrong person to answer this because I'm a very, very, very frugal woodworker. I don't buy expensive tools, but I did get the Festool Domino, the 500. What is it? I don't even know what the number of it is.
The smaller one's the 500.
Yeah, I got the smaller one, and I love it. There's no way that I would go with the larger one just because of the price. There's no way I could see myself spending $1,500 or whatever for the Domino. If I were to make large furniture like that, I would probably just use a router and then some tenoning jig on the table saw. Granted, they can do some more complex stuff than just basic mortise and tenon. That's what I would do. As far as the track saw, I don't have any experience with it. I went with the Makita. So I'm not much help on this question, but the smaller Domino and the orbital sander that I do have are amazing tools.
Yeah.
So that's about all that I've got on that one.
All right.
I would love to own more. Don't get me wrong. I mean, they're great. They make amazing stuff. It's just, man, I've got too many other things I'd rather buy.
I bought most of my stuff on eBay. I bought my Domino with the little sustainer full of the Dominoes for $700.
Nice. Yeah, actually, every Festool that I have except for the Row 90 is used. It's the Row 90 is the only thing I bought new.
Let me circle back and talk about something because of Cheap Sean. I bought cheaper CMT bits for the Domino, and they were routing a hole larger, just barely, but larger than my Dominoes. And I learned quickly that I wasted money because I had to end up making my own Dominoes because they were just slightly larger. And then it wasn't a friction fit, meaning if I were to pick a piece up, it would just completely fall off. I learned my lesson about buying the cheap bits for the Domino, you know, fork out the extra however many dollars and get the Festool bits. Have you guys, had similar findings with bits, or have you only stuck with the Festool brand?
I've just still got the ones that mine came with. I've never had to replace them.
Yeah, I did the same thing that Guy did, which was when I bought the Domino used, I got it for $800, but I got the Domino, all the accessories for the Domino that Festool makes, along with the sustainer with all the Domino tenons and the cutters, all together $800. And I bought it used.
That's a good price.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not as good as what you got, 700. Geez.
No, it's pretty close.
But yeah. So I don't even know. I don't know anything other than the Festool cutters. So
the bits that I bought were the CMT, and I know that Steve lied. I believe, Steve lied. SL1800 on Instagram. He talked about the bits having the lifespan of the bits were nowhere near as long as the Festool brand. So obviously, if you got the money, fork out for the better cutters, because you're going to have a better quality cut and they're going to last longer.
All right. I think, Sean, you have the next question.
Yeah. And we may have gotten to this one just a tad too late. And I'll explain that in just a second. But this one's from Jonathan from Instagram. Hey guys, I had another one for you. I heard in a previous episode how you guys struggled to get your bandsaws working after the riser block was installed. That bummed me out because I'm planning to get one from my Powermatic PWBS-14CS. What a model number. I got the saw in a mobile base for $700 on Craigslist. It's in perfect condition because the elderly man who bought it sadly passed away soon after. And it's got the Carter tension deal and the killer guides, lots of cast iron, etc. My question was whether or not you feel like I'd get better results using the Powermatic riser block on a Powermatic bandsaw. I'm a luthier, aspiring woodworker, and would love to be able to resaw smaller panels for guitar tops, back, sides. I wouldn't be asking too much of it in terms of huge board runs. I only foresee resawing 7 to 9 inch wide boards for now. And while I'd love to get Guy's 15 inch Powermatic bandsaw, I wonder if the $120 riser block could get me by for the next year or two until I could swing for something with greater horsepower. I don't have any experience with the Powermatic, but let me explain my situation with the Porter cable. The Porter cable did not have an aftermarket when I got mine. It did not have an aftermarket riser block. So after some research, people were apparently using the Jet branded riser block that you can get on Amazon and retrofit it to work on the Porter cable. So that's what I did. It's not a perfect install. I mean, I had to drill some holes and cut some stuff, but it was really, really simple. Now, did it work right out of the box and with a few things drilled and cut? No. I pretty much took the bandsaw apart and then I put the riser block on and put the top back on pretty much. And things were just no longer aligned. The wheels were not coplanar. I mean, it was just, it was a mess. But I don't know about the Powermatic, since it's, they make one specifically for that. I would imagine it's the same process of lifting the top off, taking two bolts off, lift the top off, put the riser block in, put the top back on and tighten it back down. Is it perfect on the Porta cable? No. Would I cut veneer with it? Absolutely not. But I will, however, cut boards a little thick and then run it through the drum sander. So I don't know what your situation is if you have a drum sander, but you're going to need to work on the panels just a little bit. I've gotten it to the point where I would feel comfortable if I need a quarter inch panel, I would make it, you know, 3/8, maybe a little thinner, and then run it through the drum sander and I'm good to go. It's not really bad. It's not perfect, but you know, I had to spend a lot of time to get it to where it is now. Obviously, if you can swing a larger bandsaw that you don't have to deal with a riser block, that would be awesome. But as far as the Powermatic is concerned, I would imagine it's the same process of taking the top off, putting the riser block in. You're going to run into maybe similar issues about alignment, and it's going to take you time to once you put the riser block in, to align everything again. If you have it, which, oh yeah, that's what I was going to say. I guess several days after you submitted this question, you tagged us on Instagram and your wife bought you the riser block. So you have no choice now but to use it. So we're going to be all positive from here on out and say, yeah, you can probably tune it up to work fairly well. Don't expect perfection. And you're going to have to work on the panel just a little bit after the fact. But you can get it to work, I would imagine. I can my Porta cable, so I would imagine that you can. Now, Guy, I know you had that Powermatic 14-inch bandsaw with the riser block, and I know you had issues. Do you care to share that with us?
Actually, I had a Jet.
Oh, sorry, Jet.
It's all right. It's all right. I had a Jet 14 inch. I put the riser block on and you can't just take the thing apart, put the riser block in, tighten the bolts up and I'm done with it. You have to set the machine up. You have to make sure that, you know, you use the word before, coplanar. You have to make sure your wheels are coplanar.
I was worried about that word.
Yeah. And it's not a perfect fit to where you put it in and there's only one way it'll go on. I mean, there's play in it.
Absolutely.
You've got to dial the thing in. I had that saw for probably close to 20 years. Anything over about 7 or 8 inches, I would get a wonky cut. And I had Carter guides on it and everything else. It just didn't matter. I never tried, nor did I purchase a saw with, or a saw blade with carbide teeth. The best luck I had with that saw was with the wood slicer blade from Highland Woodworking, 3/8 inch wood slicer. And that's what I kept on it all the time. I could cut veneer on it, but I couldn't get much thinner than 1/8 of an inch off the saw. No matter what I did, something would happen. It would go, the cut would go wonky on me. Resawing boards, you know, say you got 8/4 boards and you're cutting them in half, or you've got, you know, 1-inch boards, you're trying to get, you know, 1/2 inch, 3/8 inch stock. Not a problem at all, up to 9-10 inches. But when you try to cut thinner stock, man, it's just, you know, and you're trying to cut veneer, especially like 1/8 of an inch, 1/32 of an inch makes a big difference. Not so much on a larger cut or thicker board, if that makes any sense.
Yeah. If you want to keep the boards thicker, like Guy is saying, and you got a planer and a joiner, have at it. That'll work. Just leave a little extra stock and you're good to go.
But, you know, spending 3 hours at a drum sander trying to take off 1/8 of an inch of stock, I don't have the patience for that. All I can tell you is just when you set it up, be patient with it and make sure your wheels are as coplanar as you can get them. If you can't adjust it through the junction point where you put that riser block in, there are adjustments to the wheels you can make. And that's also a second option to you. So if it's not working there, you can switch over the other one or a combination of the two. And that's what I did. But I said 7 inches, 8 inches, I was okay with cutting, you know, as thin as 1/32 of an inch veneer. But for some reason, anytime I went above that, no matter what blade I was using, it would belly on me.
I had the same problem.
I think it's because the guides are open wide enough and it's, I don't know.
The riser blocks come with pins on each corner and they're just so loose. There's no precise fit.
Probably a lot of it had to do with user error, which is me. probably put too much tension on the blade. And that's another thing I played around with a lot was blade tension. I always felt I had to have a pretty good tension on the blade. So that might have been my fault. But, you know, it's a good saw that you got there, Jonathan. And the experience I had and Sean had with it is not necessarily the same experience you're going to have. Mm-hmm. So I wish you the best of luck and let me know how it goes. Hui, do you have anything to input into this?
So I'll caveat my experience with the fact that I had a jet bandsaw that I completely rebuilt. So it was, when I got it used, it was literally in pieces. To the best of my ability, I sanded off the sections that were powder coated, that I powder coated, and then mated the riser block to the beam as best as I could. But I had the same issue. There was quite a bit of slop. It was the jet riser block. So there was just a little bit of slop there. And so the best of my ability, I bolted that down. I tried to make the wheels coplanar. And I had pretty much the same experience where anything that was over about 7 inches, 7 to 8 inches in resaw, the blade just didn't track properly and I would get a belly. Now, again, I do not know nearly as much as I do about bandsaws, and I didn't have nearly as much experience with bandsaws. So I had a Carter spring, a new Carter spring, along with Carter guides, and I tensioned the Carter spring according to the gauge on the back of the saw. Well, we all know you don't use that, right? Because it's arbitrary. It doesn't necessarily mean anything. And especially since that gauge on the back of the saw pertains to a saw that has a much smaller blade, not one that's much larger or longer for a saw with riser blocks. So I think actually it was partially user error. I think my blade was over-tensioned, and I think that caused a little bit of vibration and flexing with the beam. But another thing to also know is that when you detach a section, now you're adding a riser block, you're adding two additional points of flex. But I've seen and I've heard of people that have had the riser block on their jet or Powermatic bandsaw, and they've had wonderful success. So yeah. I think you could probably get it working a lot better than we did.
Yeah, just remain positive and you will get it to work. I mean, you have no choice now because your wife got it for you. So you've got to get it on. All right, cool. Hope that helps. Jonathan, let us know. Hui, off to you.
All right. This question is from Jake. And he asks, I'm looking to do my first dining table and set of chairs. I love mission style arts and crafts furniture and would like to design my own rendition in a similar style. My main questions are around proper chair and table proportions, expandable table hardware, keeping tabletops flat, and how to create comfortable chairs. Okay, so first question, proportion and table proportions. So I think you're doing, first off, the right thing by talking about, you know, reference books or source material. He specifically asked, I didn't include the last part of this question, so are there any great books or resources you would recommend? And when it comes to chairs and tables, there's a really great book called Human Dimension and Interior Space by Julius Pinero and Martin Zelnick. By the way, this is not a design furniture book. It's a reference book. You go to this to get proper seat heights, human dimensions in relation to the height of a table, the height of a bar, if you're sitting at a desk versus if you're sitting at a dining table. These are the kinds of things that you would get from that book, okay? You're not going to get how to design a chair. You're not going to get how to design a table. Once you sort of create this box or boxes that your furniture piece is going to fit into, then you can start thinking outside of the box by adding shape and design elements specific to whatever motif you want to encompass, whatever that is. And you'll also still need to design around like creature comforts, things like armrests, backrests, the angle of the backrest, the tabletop shape, leg shaping, those sorts of things. And there are two books that I think would help you, and that's from Fine Woodworking Magazine. One is called Table and Chairs, and the other is Designing and Building Chairs. And both of these are going to give you sort of some quintessential design elements to the specific style that you want to design around. But they'll also give you some techniques and methods. Now, another book that I've used a lot of is Chair Making and Design by Jeff Miller. And he shows a lot of jigs and techniques for angle joinery. And if you're looking for some good comprehensive videos, if you're into videos, there are two series that I know of, which is Building a Dining Chair by Mark Spagnolo. That's the Wood Whisperer Guild. And Building an Elegant Dining Chair by Matthew Teague. That's also part of the Fine Woodworking Magazine's online subscription. So now, the next part of your question is expandable table hardware. Well, I know this guy, and his name is Guy, and he's got a really good video out, a series of videos, on making an expandable table using readily available hardware. Am I right about that, Guy? Have you heard about that guy?
I've done two different videos on it. I did made a pedestal table, which was round, and I also did a butterfly leaf table.
You go through a very, very comprehensive methods of applying that hardware, getting the hardware, what hardware you used, how it works. And I believe the hardware was relatively inexpensive. Am I correct on that?
It depends on which table you're talking about. The pedestal table I did, I actually bought all the hardware to do it. And I actually bought that from a source called Osborne Woodcraft or Woodworking. The butterfly leaf, those were just pieces, parts I got bought off of Amazon. There was really not much out there. For some reason, people hold that whole butterfly leaf thing. They hold it very close to the vest. And there's not very many written articles on it. There was only one article I could find on it. It was written by Michael Fortune, and it was in Fine Woodworking. And when I asked the people at Fine Woodworking if I could use that design on my table for a YouTube video, the response was basically, no, and if you do, we'll sue you.
Eesh.
Said, okay, thank you very much.
Well, there you go.
So I ended up just doing it myself.
They're good videos, and the materials are for that butterfly table. The materials are readily available. I definitely recommend going to Guy's YouTube, watching those videos. You'll learn how to do it, and it's not that bad. It's pretty comprehensive. So the other question here is keeping tabletops flat. Well, the books that I mentioned, Tables and Chairs and Designing and Building Chairs, both by the editors of Fine Woodworking Magazine, they're going to show you how to incorporate aprons, battens, cross bracing, those sorts of things that are necessary to keep a tabletop flat. But the most important thing to keeping a tabletop flat is making sure that the material is acclimated to the environment that it's going to stay in and that it's properly milled. Those are the best ways to keep a tabletop flat. Now, last question, how to create comfortable chairs. You know, there are different definitions to what comfort is. And the last thing that I'd encourage you to do is build a prototype or a mock-up, especially with a chair, but maybe even with a scale mock-up of a dining table, like to scale, not like full size, but just a scale mock-up of a dining table. It doesn't have to be a full-blown prototype chair like what I did, but it's worth using some scrap to throw together the dimensions of your chair to try to get an understanding of whether or not the furniture piece is going to be comfortable. Now, Sean, I know you recently designed and built a set of bar stools. Do you have any tips about your process that you'd like to share with Jake?
Yeah, the first thing is I 100% agree with you on making a prototype. I mean, dude, if you can, please do that. And the reason why I say that is I ran into, now that I've got the bar stools done, they're not comfortable. And the reason why I say that is the footrest, the aprons on the front and the back are way too low. The ones on the sides are the perfect height. If I were to do this again, I would switch those around. So my legs are off to the side on those side aprons more than they are on the front. You know, live and learn. If you can make a prototype, that's amazing because you're going to save. Like right now, I don't really sit in them because it's not the most comfortable experience. As far as I've never made like a kitchen table with an expanding table hardware. So I don't have any information on that other than, you know, you've covered it pretty well. But I do often go back to the illustrated cabinet making for specs on building like side tables and coffee tables, end tables, just for dimensions. Now, when it came time to making the bar stools, you know, I just looked out on the internet and saw dimensions of other bar stools because you got pretty much a couple different cabinet heights and my or countertop. And my countertop is a taller 37 inch countertop height. I can't remember the exact number. So I just took some dimensions and modified accordingly. And those came out perfect. The height are perfect. It's just being able to make a prototype, I would have noticed that the foot placement is just off. That's pretty much my experience on this. Guy, what about you?
I don't have a lot of experience making chairs. I've made a bunch of chairs in my time, but they were mostly shaker style chairs. And that was a long time ago. I haven't made a chair in probably 20 years. As far as source material for that, Pui covered that very well. I was going to recommend anything that Jeff Miller has written on chairs. And I know he wrote a book for Taunton Press on it that I think you talked about before, Pui. As far as tabletops go, there's a lot of different ways you can keep them flat. As we said before, battens and aprons. I gave up on all that stuff probably 15 years ago. And just started making them out of plywood and putting veneer on top of them. Chop sawn veneer.
There you go.
Typically eighth inch. It stays flat that way. They don't split. They don't warp. They don't do anything. It pretty much is very stable when you put in an apron underneath it. I never had any problems with those tables. I did have a lot of problems with hardwood tops, you know, that are 5-6 feet long. You know, it's the width that's the killer on it. Mm-hmm. You know, the dining room table is typically around 42 inches wide, 36 inches to 42 inches wide. And you've got that wide of a boards on there all glued up, man, it's just gonna, there's a lot of movement that can happen in those tables. And you have to be really, really aware of what you're doing with them. Breadboard ends are a good option.
Mm-hmm.
Battens are a good option. Aprons are so-so. Aprons work well to keep a table flat, but not as much as like a batten or a breadboard ends. That being said, as far as the expandable part, yeah, I've built a few expandable tables in my time. You can do them with slides. You can do them with the butterfly design. There's a lot of different ways you can do them. There's actually a ton of stuff written about those. All the different magazines and I'm not sure which books would have it, but I know there's been a lot of written articles and magazines on them. So I think another good resource for that is Tommy McDonald wrote a really good article for Fine Woodworking on how to make wooden sliding mechanisms underneath the table. That was pretty good. It's about all I can add to what you guys mentioned.
Well, I think we're back to Guy. You've got our next question.
All right. This is a fun one.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy. This is from Christopher, and he says, hey, one of you guys, not guys, guy, said you wouldn't buy a SawStop saw, that they're great saws for a lesser price. I also don't fear cutting my hand as much as Kickback. I was wondering what some other saws are on the market you would suggest over SawStop. I kid a lot on the SawStop thing. SawStop, it's a great saw, good documentation. The fit and finish on those things is just top notch. They're beautiful saws, and again, very well made. They are just very, very expensive. And I guess just for me, I don't appreciate the marketing campaign, which is if you don't get one of our saws, you will die. I really don't. It just rubs my fur the wrong way. When I was looking on replacing my table saw, I looked at the saw stops. I looked at Powermatic and I looked at Grizzly. And the Grizzly, they have a model. I think it's the 1023. It's about $1,600. And it's a great saw for the money. You compare that to the comparable saw stop. Now, there's the thing. Everybody thinks that the PCS, or their professional cabinet saw stop, is comparable to the 1023 Grizzly or, let's say, the Powermatic PM2000. That is not true. If it were true, why does it weigh over 200 pounds less? It has to do with the internal workings of the saw. If you ever saw a saw stop saw, a PCS sitting next to, let's say, a PM2000, and you looked underneath the hood, it's a huge difference in the amount of cast iron underneath it. You really have to, if you're going to compare anything in the SawStop line, you have to compare it to the ICS or their industrial cabinet saw. It's about the same weight, give or take, you know, 50, 75 pounds as the Grizzly or the Powermatic. And it's a beast of a saw. It's also $4,300 in comparison to the Grizzly's $1,400, $1,500. Mm-hmm. That being said, I went with the Powermatic. I got a good price on it. Powermatic runs a lot of sales where you can get 10% off. And I think on Black Friday, they give you 15 or 20% off. I think it's 15% off. But they run 10% off a couple, three times a year, and you can save some money on them that way. SawStop, it's never on sale, and it's the same price everywhere. Sometimes they add, you know, you can get the overarm dust collection or the mobile base for free, which is a couple $100. Most places have free shipping on the Powermatic and the SawStop. So make sure you don't pay shipping on those. Grizzly, you'll pay shipping on, which is a couple $100. So you need to add that to the price of your saw. I can't really add much to that other than, you know, look around. For me, the only three saws I looked at again were the SawStop, the Powermatic, and the Grizzly. And I went with the Powermatic because I think I got it like 15% off. Don't quote me on that. I think I got it for 15% off. It was more money than the Grizzly, but it had a few more features on it I liked. And it mainly had to do with the dust collection. Mm-hmm. The Grizzly does not have a shroud over the blade that goes into the 4-inch port while the Powermatic did. And I could not see a Grizzly. That's the only thing with Grizzly. Unless you're willing to drive to Washington State to look at one of these things. I think they have something near St. Louis too. I wasn't about to drive 5-6 hours to go look at a saw. So I could never see one, but I've heard good things about them. I know people that have them. They've said very good things about the Grizzly. Mm-hmm. But that's why I went with the Powermatic. Now, Hui, I know you have a SawStop.
Yeah, I have a SawStop. It is a great saw, but you're right. If you look at the weight of the SawStop and you compare it to the PM2000, there's a 250-pound difference. If you look at the PM1000, that is a lot more comparable. That being said, their PCS does have a 1 3/4 horsepower option and a 3-horsepower option. I went with the 3-horsepower option. Mm-hmm. One thing that I want to mention, and I think, Guy, you'll agree with this, two things. First off, just because you have a saw stop does not constitute poor usage of a table saw. That would just be stupid. Second thing, I absolutely love my Jessam clear cut stock guides. And I think they are the best investment to ensure or restrict the possibility of kickback. Guy, I think you'd agree with me on that.
Yeah, that's one thing I didn't mention. You know, the thing with the SawStop is, you know, if you stick your hand in the blade, it won't cut your fingers off. That's all fine and dandy, but kickback is the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. So all the saws nowadays have riving knives. Mm-hmm. That helps tremendously with kickback. You combine those with the Jessam clear cut stock guides you're talking about. Kickback is pretty much an impossibility.
Yeah.
I don't see how it could kick back.
So if you're aware of where your body is in conjunction to the blade and you're using good table saw practices, I think a less expensive, high quality saw with the Jessam clear cut stock guides are a great combination. And with the clear cut stock guides added into the price, you're not even going to come close to the price of a saw stop. That being said, I like my saw stop. Sean?
Yeah, it's a nice saw. In my eyes, there's pros and cons for, you know, what I think. Some of the pros are the fit and finish, like I was saying. I mean, it isn't a really nice saw, and the setup guide that you get with the documentation is amazing. You cannot mess it up. It's probably the best that I've seen on all the tools that I have. And one of the pros, whether or not you want to call it that, is the flush sensing technology, just in case a mistake happens. I understand kickback is more likely than getting your finger cut off in the saw. But the one time that I accidentally would, I haven't, but you know, all it takes is one accident. And I'm a programmer coder guy. I use my fingers. I would rather pay the extra, you know, $1,000 just in case. I get it. It's their marketing campaign of get this or you will die. I get it. I didn't agree with that either. And, you know, I just think it's worth it for me. Now, am I going to use the saw any different? No, I'm going to be on point just as much if I were to have this saw versus some skill $70 contractor saw. And I don't believe people that say, well, just because you got a saw stop now that they don't think they have to treat it a certain way and they just do whatever. I've heard people say that, and I completely disagree with that. If people treat the saw different because they have a saw stop and they're careless,
you shouldn't buy a table saw.
No, you shouldn't, because if you're careless, you're going to trigger a cartridge that's $70. You're going to trigger a cartridge that's going to have to replace your blade. You are going to be out so much money. And not only that, you're probably going to have to check and dial in your table saw after so many of those triggers. Like, I had to dial in my table saw just a little bit after the cartridge triggered. So if you're treating it any different, you're a fool.
What caused the trigger?
I cut into an aluminum T-track. I thought I measured it right. I didn't. I triggered it and it ruined a blade and a cartridge. So if anything, I'm more cautious and more hesitant, and I second guess myself about cuts more so now because I don't want to mess up that cartridge in the blade.
You don't have a fear of cutting your hand off. You have a fear of...
No, I don't even get close. Yeah, I don't even want to turn it on because I'm afraid I'm going to run into.
Can't you defeat that safety feature if you want?
Oh, you can, but I told myself I would rather figure it out instead of bypassing it. Because if I'm bypassing it, I'm doing something either the saw doesn't think is right or something that's wrong. Yeah. But if you treat the saw any different because of that, you're crazy because you're going to spend way more money. Some of the cons, not only the price of the saw, but you got the price of the cartridges. You got the price. If you got a regular 10-inch blade, you've got one type of cartridge. If you have a dado stack, you've got to get another type of cartridge.
Right.
Those are some of the cons of owning a flush sensing table saw technology gadgetry.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Proprietary inserts as well?
Yes. But it's a great saw. The dust collection is pretty good. And the fact that the saw comes with an over the blade, I don't guess it's over the blade. It's dust collection at the blade. I guess I don't know if you'd call it over the blade. It's not an arm, but it's built into the, what are those things called, Hui?
The guard.
Guard.
Yeah,
guard,
there you
guard.
Go.
Yeah,
it's built into the guard. That's pretty cool. But
you don't have to use their overarm, boom arm. You don't have to use theirs. You can outfit your own if you want.
Yeah.
If you think you are experienced enough with a table saw where you don't have to, you know where the blade is and where your hands are at all times with the saw, and the flush sensing technology isn't a big deal, there's a lot of other saws out there to take a look at.
Right.
On the other hand, I see a lot of people getting into woodworking that are maybe a year or two into it, and they're upgrading from their job site portable saw right into a saw stop. I would almost agree with that because they don't have the years of experience that other people do. They're buying their last saw first. You know, this is my fourth table saw over my career. So, and it's the last one I'll probably buy. Never say never. All right. Well, I think, Sean, you've got the last question there, Chief.
Awesome. This is from Jesse, Beachland Furniture. Hi, guys. The podcast is great, and I'm loving the format of Q&A. I had two questions below for the podcast. Keep up the good work. Number one, how do you handle machine noise and neighbors? I'm currently in the process of building a shop and have neighbors pretty close on all three sides, about 15 and 20 feet away. I think my best option is to go with 2x8 plates with staggered stud wall with rock wool weaved in between the studs and 5/8 drywall. What other options do you guys use to reduce noise? When I had my house built, I luckily had them insulate the garage. So the outer wall is insulated and the garage door is insulated. Other than that, I just keep my door closed. And the noise is not that bad. And luckily, the neighbor on the left side of my house is really cool and doesn't, even if he does hear something with the door open, is, you know, doesn't complain and often comes over and chats with me. And I've talked to him about it, and he said with the door closed, he can't even hear it standing outside. So when he's in the house, he especially can't hear it. So it sounds like you may be onto something. I don't know much about construction of homes. I'm not sure what rock wool weaved in between this. Is that insulation?
I have no idea.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I have no idea either.
Yeah. So it sounds like it's some type of rock wool weaved in. Yeah. So it sounds like that may help with the 2x8 plates, staggered stud wall. It sounds like he knows what he's talking about, throwing all these terms out there.
So rock wool is, I think, also known as mineral wool, is any fibrous material formed by spinning or drawing molten mineral or rock materials such as slag and ceramic.
Huh. Yeah, what he said. So if you can do that with insulation, again, I'm terrible with this stuff, but I don't know if you plan to keep your doors open or closed when you work, but again, I just have insulation in my wall and the door is insulated and I keep it closed and noise is not a concern. So you may just turn your dust collection on and some other tool and just go outside and listen, or have someone, you know, stay in the garage while you go outside and listen just to make sure nothing happens, but it shouldn't. Just listen for yourself. I mean, because once you get about 10 feet away from my garage, you couldn't tell that anything is even on, mm-hmm. on the inside of my shop with tools going. That would be my recommendation on part one of this question. Before I move on to the second one, Hui, do you have any opinions on part one of this question of the noise?
No, I think insulation has been very good for me. My garage has two exterior walls along with insulated garage doors. And then that butts up against my house, which is also separated with an insulated wall. So that actually that interior wall is insulated as well. I've talked to my neighbors. I'm on 3/4 acre and they've never noticed in that way. So Guy, how about you?
I really don't give a damn if my neighbors are annoying. how's them apples?
There you go. Next question.
I don't operate my machinery, and I'm serious about that. I don't operate my machinery pretty much after 7-8 o'clock at night. I'm usually done by, 5-6 o'clock, if not sooner than that. So I'm not doing it at all hours of the night. My shop is insulated. My neighbors are not that close, but they're not that far either. I live in a pretty standard bedroom community subdivision. I nobody has ever said anything to me, ever. So I don't worry about it. If you are worried about it, go talk to your neighbors and see how much it bothers them. Do they have do they have babies at home or my age where they're sleeping all day? do they take a lot of naps in the afternoon after lunch,
And go to bed early?
Yeah. It's questions you might want to ask them.
Yeah, you may be surprised when you go outside of your shop and shut the doors and listen that you really don't hear much, depending on how well it's insulated. And also, I only have one exterior wall, and it does not have a window or anything like that. So that's our setup anyways. It's pretty good advice on that. Part two, dust collection in the floor, yes or no? I was thinking maybe 1/6-inch line coming where the table saw would be located and everything else located on the perimeter walls. If I was able to run DC down the floor or in the floor down the center of the shop, I would definitely do it. I would do what you were mentioning of a 6-inch line coming to where the table saw is, because that would allow me to switch up my configuration and put the joiner next to the table saw or the bandsaw next to the table saw and not have any of the pipes running across the floor. But again, to me, if I had that opportunity, I definitely would. And especially if I were to run and put a router insert on the extension of my table saw, I wouldn't be able to have my current configuration of it coming down from the ceiling because the couple of hoses that are coming down are going to get in the way. So having that in the floor would be amazing. And if I had that option, I would definitely do it. And I agree with you. Everything else running along the wall, that's how I have mine set up, except for this table saw. I have it coming down from the ceiling instead of up from the floor. If it were me, I would definitely do that, running it down the center under the floor. What about you, Guy? What would you do on the floor run?
If I had the ability to do it, I would definitely do it. I'd have power in the floor and dust collection in the floor. You just have to make sure that, you know, you're able to clean it out if it gets clogged. But other than that, go for it, man. Do it. If you can do it, do it. Run as much stuff under the floor as you can. I mean, if you're building your own shop, you can make the ceilings as high as you want. So instead of putting it into the slab, put it on top of the slab and build yourself a nice wooden floor over the top of everything. Then you won't have to be standing on concrete all day long.
Oh, that'd be nice.
And that would.
Absolutely. You could have some nice, and then you can run all the electricity. If it changes, you can move it somewhere else.
Yep.
Because all you have to do is pull up a piece of plywood and you're golden.
Yep.
If it were me, that's what I would do. If I was building from scratch, I'd actually have a crawl space underneath the thing where I could get underneath there and pull wires and dust collection and everything else. Everything would be under the floor. Hui?
Well, like all you guys, I don't have dust collection or electricity in the floor, but if I could, I would. So
there you go.
Especially the electricity. I didn't even think about that, but that's awesome.
Yeah, imagine a shop where you didn't have dust collection hoses and wires anywhere.
Yeah. Wireless.
You could put your machines in the middle of your floor and not have to worry about that crap. Mm-hmm. And if you build on a subfloor and put your stuff underneath there, like I said, if you moved your machines around, no big deal. You pull up some plywood, you move some runs around, and you're golden. Yep. So.
Yep. If you do it in concrete, you're kind of stuck.
Me, I'm pretty lucky. I mean, even though my shop is mobile, I only have one thing on my, I have one line on my floor I have to step over, which is my dust collection for my table saw. Other than that, there's no electrical cords on the floor. There's no dust collection anywhere on the floor now since I put that manifold in.
Yeah. My table saw run, it's a 220. I don't know if it's up to snuff as far as the code is concerned, but I have some really thick 220 cable that runs along the wall, up the wall, over and down with the dust collection. So it drops right at the table saw. It was expensive, but I don't have cable going across the floor.
Right.
And it works pretty well.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that'll do it for this show. Please remember this podcast is here to answer your questions from the woodworking community. So if you have any woodworking questions you would like answered, you can send them through the podcast contact page at woodshoplifepodcast.com. Or don't forget, you can DM us through Instagram at woodshoplife. We would also like to thank everyone who left us a 5-star review on iTunes. That really helps in the search rankings. And of course, we truly appreciate the support and feedback. You can reach me at simplecove.com and at simplecove on Instagram and YouTube. What about you, Hui? Where can you be found?
You can find me at alabamawoodworker.com, and all the links to my social media are on my website. Guy?
Guyswoodshop.com.
Awesome. Thanks for listening. We'll see you in a couple of weeks.
All right. Adios. See you guys.